Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And welcome aboard Mind Food Radio. Hello, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, look, very, very well. A big program lined up today.
It sure is. And because the weather has been so wet.
Oh, everywhere.
We've asked our resident gardening editor, Angus Stewart, to give us a few tips about gardening.
Get in the gum boots and get in here.
Exactly. And also our personal trainer, David Welsh, about, well, how do you train in the wet weather?
And what else is coming up on today's program?
Well, we've got a really interesting guest, Christine Snow, and she's talking all about anti-aging and beauty and skincare,
which huge market that,
and also Cindy O'Meara. Now I know you've been off recently,
Cindy,
for a cholesterol checkup, so she's going to give us some update on that as well.
We'll talk to her as well, and of course lots of giveaways. So keep with us here on Mind Food Radio,
Mind Food Magazine, and Mind Food Radio together, smart thinking.
Anti-aging, we're all into it. Michael, do you use moisturisers? I do.
Well, I got to tell you, men's particularly, it's the fastest growing group in terms of that whole beauty and skincare arena. And skincare for a lot of beauty brands are the big growth area. On today's show, we have Christine Snow, who is the National Education Manager from True Solutions. Welcome to the show, Christine.
Thank you very much.
Now, today we'd really like to talk about anti-aging because that is a huge growth. I know there are billions spent every year from cosmetic companies, with different, I guess, hopes and jars in terms of, the whole thing around anti-aging. Tell us some tips in and around that.
Well, anti-aging is really the number one buzz, if you like, at the moment. Everyone's looking for solutions to look younger because we all feel younger. But in a market that is saturated and loaded with unsubstantial claims, how do you choose the right product? And I think that is the big question.
Yeah.
So a lot of products are making claims, so you have to find out, well, how substantial are they? So the questions I always ask people to ask is, well, who made it? Because one of the biggest problems we have out there is people bringing up Me Too ingredients. You notice yourself, there'll be AHAs will come out. Suddenly everyone's got AHAs. There's peptides or other ingredients.
Yes.
Everybody suddenly got them.
The other big thing I've noticed lately is that every beauty product seems to be organic, or green or sustainable. It's amazing how many can make that claim.
That's exactly right, exactly. And the claims aren't always substantiated.
No.
So look for clinical trials, look for clinical testing.
Mm.
Ask them to prove, well, what is it going to do for my skin and how can you prove that? Well, what proof is there?
I suppose the trap that most people fall into, Christine, they think if they're spending more, it's got to be better.
Yes. Main thing about a cosmetic product is how it has been formulated, how it has been put put together. It's not necessarily even just about the ingredients, because if they're not put together correctly, they won't work.
Do you think the consumer has become a lot more knowledgeable and aware of what ingredients are in products and that they're actually putting on their face than they have been ever before?
Oh, absolutely, particularly in the Australian market. Australian women are incredibly savvy. And if you have a look at the internet and the number of hits on things like AHAs and peptides and coffee berry, people are out there searching and doing their own research and their own homework beforehand. So they're actually quite well educated. That means they're quite keen to be choosing the right product for themselves.
So how do you know what is the right product for yourself?
Well, I always suggest you go to a skincare professional, first of all, because you need someone who can do a consultation on your skin, talk to you about, well, what is it you want to achieve personally? And then they can prescribe the sorts of products. They can talk about the deadline, what are you hoping to achieve these? What are your expectations?
Mm.
And they can work out the best plan for you. So if you go to a specialist beauty salon, medispa, someone who is fully trained, confident and competent in their field, I always say, but get them to look at your skin and work with them. Don't be told by them. Work with them to come up with a plan for your skin.
Is there proof, though, that all this stuff that we buy and put on our faces and stuff contributes to anti-aging?
Well, it does. Anything that goes on the skin basically and protects the skin from the environment will help prevent aging to a degree. What we're looking at is how much anti-aging do we want? Do we want to start reversing the visible signs of skin aging? And that's where we're at the moment. It's not just a case of prevention. We want to get rid of those lines and wrinkles and that pigmentation, that uneven skin tone.
Is it worse in the city and as compared to the country?
Well, the difference with the city, you might get a bit more shade in the city from tall buildings,
yeah.
but the difference in the city is you get more free radicals, and that's why you need the moisturiser right. with lots of antioxidants in it.
Mm-hmm. I tell you what, Christine, we've learnt so much about skincare and anti-aging. You are our Snow White of anti-aging today.
It is such an enthusiastic subject.
Thank you for being with us.
You're
and
welcome.
We'll talk to you next time. And of course, for more details, jump onto mindfood.com for more details on skincare and anti-aging. We love prizes. What's in the cupboard today?
We sure do. And one of my favourite movies I have seen over the last year, it's The Woman on the Sixth Floor, and it's a DVD.
Yep.
You can go in the drawer to win one of five copies, valued at $35. It's a really fun film set in 1962 Paris.
Oh, lovely.
And it's where a conservative couple lives are turned upside down by Spanish maids who live upstairs. It's fantastic. I love that movie.
So to find out more details, jump onto mindfood.com. And also, you can also grab a subscription there. If you're looking for something to give away as well.
That's right. Head to mindfood.com and you can get a subscription to Mind Food Magazine.
This is Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking.
Now, recently, I went to the doctor for just a general checkup. I know you love these segments, Michael. However, my cholesterol came back and it was over 7.
Cindy, welcome to the show. It's great to have you back on.
Thank you, Michael.
So what do you think? Being at number 7, is that good or bad?
I'm on red rice extract at the moment.
Red rice extract, so they didn't put you on any cholesterol-lowering drugs?
No, absolutely against it.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had all the tests, and I had to go to St. Vincent's Hospital for all these scans, and now you're going to tell me something different.
Yeah, well, usually if it's 6.18, because that's the limit that they say that if you don't do it, my gosh, you're going to die of heart disease tomorrow, they'll put you on cholesterol-lowering tablets. So I'm quite surprised that at 7 they didn't. But let's just have a look at cholesterol levels. So first of all, there's the overall total cholesterol level, which you have at 7.
Mm.
And, you know, for me, I don't think that it is a high level because we've also got to have a look at HDLs and your LDLs before we can really decipher whether you know number 7 is the right number or is a wrong number or a bad number or a good number.
Yeah.
But first of all, we do know this, that high cholesterol is not a disease. It's an indicator.
Yep.
And everybody has this thing that if we take the indicator down, then we'll be fine. But that's not the case. The case is that, well, what is it an indicator for? So it could be an indicator for copper and iron deficiency. It could be an indicator that you have an injury in your body because your cholesterol will go up if you have an injury.
Oh.
It could be inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be eating a food that's causing inflammation, or you could have arthritis that's causing inflammation that will cause your cholesterol to go up. Because why it goes up is that the body's needs increase. So cholesterol is one of the precursors for healing.
Right.
It's also good for coagulation processes. It's also good for making your calcium pumps work. It has a lot of functions.
Mm.
A high cholesterol may also indicate hypothyroidism. So maybe we need to look at your thyroid before we actually take the indicator down. And this is what the problem is at the moment, is that we see cholesterol as a number. The number changes from day to day. So let's just say you had an injury, or you had some inflammation because you ate a food that wasn't good for you, or something like that was happening, and you got 7 that day. You might go back tomorrow or the next day and have a change of 1.8 millimoles per deciliter.
Right.
So in other words, instead of being 7, you could be 5.2, which would put you in the perfect zone.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it is interesting when you really look into it. And all people see is high cholesterol means I'm going to die of heart disease, and it doesn't mean that at all, because people who have a heart attack sometimes have cholesterol levels 3 and below. But when you actually look at just single things rather than looking holistically, you're actually looking down the barrel of a microscope and declaring something that may not actually be the truth.
Mm.
So what I do is I don't actually look at little indicators. Yes, they're important, but I actually say to the person, okay, well, how are the bowels working? How do you feel when you get up in the morning? Are you sleeping well? So I'll ask all of these questions in order to understand how the person is actually feeling. Then we'll look at the holistic thing. So, you know, cholesterol is needed to make vitamin D in the body. Mm. Vitamin D is very necessary for your immune function, for making sure your gut works properly. It's important for a range of things to work. So if your cholesterol's high, you bring it down, you haven't got vitamin D anymore, then you'll find your bowel doesn't work, your hormones start not working properly, you may have sexual dysfunction, and all of these things start to happen. So science actually starts to look at the body as a black and white thing. Oh, well, if cholesterol's high, you'll get heart disease, we better bring it down and everything will be okay.
Well, that's what they were worried about, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not the case.
Yeah.
Cindy, thanks so much for being on today's show. As always, it's been a pleasure.
You're very welcome.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And you're back on Mind Food Radio. Of course, for any of our interviews that you hear on the program, jump onto mindfood.com. This is a very interesting one.
It is. We've got the CEO and founder of Street, Rebecca Scott. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, guys.
Now, you provide training and hospitality for people in and around Melbourne, don't you?
Look, Street's what's called a social enterprise, and a social enterprise is a hybrid organisation that's kind of half charity, half business. And we provide training for young people who are at high risk of homelessness or been homeless, and we do that in the area of hospitality. So we also run some cafes around inner Melbourne where they get that training and support from us.
Now, how do you find these kids, or how do they find you?
Look, a combination of ways. Sometimes they'll hear about us and come directly to us, and then other times there'll be welfare agencies who they might have them on their books and they then refer them to us.
It's pretty scary in today's world that we talk about homelessness, isn't it?
Oh, look, absolutely. In a country like ours that is just so prosperous, to think that we have every single night thousands and thousands of young people in this state that are homeless.
Why is it? What's the causes?
Look, the young people who come to us have a whole range of causes, I guess. It's almost like homelessness is a final symptom of what has been for them sometimes years and years, if not decades, of issues. So it might be family issues at home with mum and dad, or kind of extended family. We have quite a lot of young people who might come having kind of family violence, lots of drug and alcohol abuse. Mental health is often an issue for either the families of our young people or our young people themselves. So there can be lots and lots of reasons, and often many of those at the same time.
And helping them and training them and getting them into employment, do they also go on courses to kind of see the bigger picture? You know, I think what you guys do is absolutely extraordinary. But is there also help there in terms of looking back at perhaps, you know, making decisions and the path that they chose might not have been the right one?
We would actually call ourselves probably more of a wellbeing program. So yes, we're training young people in hospitality.
Yeah.
But we're absolutely about thinking about this young person and what they need to be well longer term. So they're not just getting training in hospitality with us, but we're addressing a whole bunch of the underlying issues that they might have. So it might be that drug and alcohol. It might be their health, either their physical or mental health. So there's a whole bunch of kind of individual things that we work with them on, but also group things as well. So we like to think that by the end of the 6 months that they're with us, a lot of the issues that they have you know, really been stabilised. But they've also now got some amazing skills as well in hospitality that makes them, you know, very employable. So I guess we're thinking about the broader person, not just one little sliver of their life.
Sure. Is there a choice also? Some people choose to be homeless?
I don't think many people ever choose to be homeless. It takes such an enormous stress on a person to be homeless. And I would say to people, if it's better to be on the streets for a young person, that's a safer place to be, imagine what home must be like.
Mm. Rebecca, thanks for being on the show today. The work you do is fantastic. And there's one thing about seeing an idea or having an idea or an opportunity, but you've really gone out and made it happen. So congratulations to you and
thanks
the team.
Thanks very much.
Because the work you do is extraordinary. It really is.
Thanks very much, guys. My pleasure.
Not a problem. Very interesting topic, and one that really does concern everybody in every part of the world.
It does, and it's amazing just recently how many different sort of organisations have approached us about the theme of homelessness. This one I just thought was fantastic in that they really are so proactive in getting out there and getting these kids, you know, trained and working and feeling better about themselves and contributing to society. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about.
Visit mindfood.com today. Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
And welcome back to Mind Food Radio, smart thinking. Well, before the break, we were talking with Rebecca Scott, CEO, founder of Street. Very, very interesting cause. And now on the line, Michael,
we've got the chef, Rob Alger, who I guess really works with these kids and really upskills them. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
How do you cook up a storm to help these street kids?
We've got a kitchen at one of our main cafe sites. We also run a production kitchen where we supply food to any of our four cafe sites across Melbourne. We have trainees in the kitchen probably over a three-day period of the week when they're doing their training with us. And a lot of what they do in the initial stages is, I guess, go through the beginnings of any sort of intro to cookery as any, I suppose, student or apprentice of cookery would do. And then over the six-month period, I guess we start amping things up, and the end game is, from a kitchen perspective, is to have them fully participating in an a la carte service.
I love that idea of a cafe. That sounds pretty cool.
I think one of the things that's ideal about the cafe is that it provides, an entry-level experience for a lot of trainees. I come from, a fine dining background myself, but what a cafe does is it allows them to get some of the basic skills down with still, obviously, some fairly high-speed pressure, but give them many pathways after they leave the program. So it might be going on to another cafe job. It might be going on to catering. Some people might decide to go on to fine dining, but it gives them 6 months to sort of have a bit of a play
around.
Do they
gain a qualification?
Absolutely. Over the six-month period that they're with us, they get a Cert 2 in hospitality. Again, that's probably an entry-level certificate, but what it'll allow them to do is get all of the basics to be able to go on and have any job in hospitality, at least an entry-level position. So we've run them through a series of kitchen experiences. They'll work point of sale. They can wait tables. Being a barista is very popular these days, so we certainly have a lot of training that goes towards that as well. And at the end of the day, they come out with a certificate to in hospitality and hopefully the confidence to, enter the workforce, hopefully in hospitality. But I guess for us, we're just as happy if they have the confidence and employability skills to go on to any type of career, really.
Now, your background in, chefing and cooking is very professional. You've worked for some extraordinary restaurants across the world. How different has it been for you in taking something like this on?
The major pressures that we face is trying to pass on, the work ethic that's been instilled in myself, over the throughout working in some of these restaurants across the world into the trainees and make sure that they can absorb as much as they can in a short period of time.
So, Rob, what are some of the success stories you've seen?
Some of the grander success stories is when somebody comes out the other end and is launching into a full apprenticeship at another restaurant. One of the more interesting success stories that we've had is somebody who hasn't necessarily gone on to hospitality but decided to use some of the hospitality skills they learned to help pay for a university education.
That's great.
Absolutely ecstatic if somebody goes on to a hospitality career. But the reality for us is we're also just looking at teaching employability skills and helping people gain the confidence to go out and do whatever they'd like to do, and a lot of the skills that you learn in hospitality, such as accountability, working in a team, camaraderie, being able to take constructive feedback are transferable across all sorts of jobs, I'd like to think.
Finally, what would life be for these kids without what you're doing?
Rather than, taking a stab or conjecture at where they'd be without the program, I do like to think that we certainly have made a difference in where they're going.
Yeah.
Some of the people that come into the program, the self-esteem is low enough that perhaps they wouldn't even be able to look someone in the eye, let alone, work in any setting with them. Mm. And over that period of time, we're hopefully building up their self-confidence to be able to help them make decisions about where they want to go.
Fantastic. Well, Rob Alger, we've been chatting about this wonderful street cafe, and you're the chef there. Thank you very much for your time today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Exercise is the key to happiness. Oh, all our doctors and psychologists talk about it.
Can't get enough of it. I tell you what, I am finding it very hard, though, in the wet weather to get out there and get fit. What about you?
Do you walk around with an umbrella when you're doing your walks around the park there? Or
no, I just wear a hooded top that's waterproof. Yeah. And it hasn't stopped me.
David Welsh is with us now.
Our personal trainer. How are you, David?
Very, very well, you guys. And yourself?
Yeah, good, mate.
Now, is this a quiet time of the year for you, or just as busy being winter?
Funnily enough, for a lot of my clients, it's the time that I really try and push them to really focus more on their exercise, because it's the time that most people have a tendency to gain the most weight.
And why is that?
For the simple fact that, you know, who really wants to eat a cold salad in the middle of winter? We look for warmer foods, heavier foods, and comfort foods. So this is where I generally get a lot of my clients to really try and knuckle down and focus on their training and really be aware of what they're putting into their mouth.
Hey, tell me, a lot of your clients that come in, you're talking about comfort foods. How many of them do you reckon would be, you know, suffering a lot from stress in just everyday life?
Oh, listen, I would say close to probably 100% of my clients go through stress. There's all different types of stress. I deal with my mothers who deal with the daily grind of being a mother, and juggling kids, getting them to school on time, getting them to activities on time, and then weekend activities, and then trying to find time for themselves. I deal with the dads that have the financial burden of making sure that, you know, everything can run smoothly so that I get the opportunity to train their wives.
Now, how do you get fit when it's raining and wet?
So what do we do with all this rain?
Well, at the moment, for a lot of my clients, you know, it's some that, for example, live in apartments. One of the easiest things I say is, how many stairs do you have in the apartment? Yeah. And you can start walking just up and down the stairs, even just to keep things going. You can time it as well. You can think, okay, how fast did it take me to get up those flight of stairs? Walk back down nice and slowly, and then go back up again. If you can aim to do that, you know, maybe 10 or 15 laps, trust me, that will be a good, solid workout in itself.
Yeah, that is good advice. And what about if you don't live in an apartment?
If you don't live in an apartment, then the other thing we can always look for is what you might have in the house. You can just simply look for a little pantry full of food. what we could do with the pantry is we could turn around and put our hands on it and turn around and do some tricep dips, for example.
Michael has the fittest right arm from opening that door in that pantry.
That sounds rude. No. What about a couch and a TV in front of it?
And his left hand with the remote?
Yeah. Yes. So we've just got to balance it and put the DVD control on the other side, so we've got two things that he can lift up at the same time.
He's gardening. You know, he's trying to do everything at the minute.
But, you know, it can be as simple as just doing some, a nice little circuit. You can be doing it in the middle of your lounge room, like just doing some squats and some push-ups and some planks and some crunches, all sorts of things just to keep you moving until you can get yourself back outdoors and hopefully experience the type of workout that you generally like to do.
Is walking in the rain bad for you?
As long as you're covered from head to toe and you're going to stay nice and warm, it's not ideal. There are definitely other things that, you know, I would suggest, but walking is still a form of exercise. But I would suggest to not walk in the rain if possible.
Well, we had a doctor on a couple of weeks ago, and he was all about brain health and things like that. He was fascinating, and he said how he gets fit is that he bought an exercycle and put it in front of the TV and actually watched DVDs that he really liked. So the focus actually wasn't on the exercise, it was what he was enjoying watching.
Absolutely, because you can generally, I mean, I know when I have some of my clients and I've seen them come on to do their cardiovascular work in the gym, and I've seen them, and the two of them have just jumped on a treadmill next to each other, and before you know it, they said, wow, I can't believe my 40 minutes is up.
So
it always helps. I mean, if you can distract yourself and put yourself into something that you are enjoying, like a good DVD or a movie or something that you want to watch, before you know it, you think, wow, it's been 45 minutes that I've been on here. No wonder that my carpet looks like it's soaked in sweat.
Mm. Hey, that's great. Thanks, David. Talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
Thanks, David. And, of course, for more details, jump onto mindfood.com. I've got to change the way I think about going to the gym.
Well, I think if you started going to the gym.
Mindfood Magazine and Mindfood Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Now time on the program for a topic that everybody loves. This is the segment called My Story. Michael, what's that all about?
Well, My Story is when, we hear about someone's story, and it could be anything. It could be about transformation in their life. It could be about something that's happened in their life or a moment in their life that they share with us. And today, on today's show, we have Leah Barthel-Crammons, who has got an interesting story. Her mother recently passed away, and she became an organ donor. Leah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, tell us about your journey so far in and around with your mother.
Okay, our journey was that my mum actually hadn't been sick. She was what we thought perfectly fine. We actually were out spending the day together, and all of a sudden her speech became slurred, and we called paramedics within a half an hour in St Vincent's Hospital, and they were telling me that she'd had a massive aneurysm, and if they didn't operate, she wasn't going to make it. And he asked me to sit down, and when he said that, I just knew that things were not good. And he told me that she was not responding the way they'd anticipated, and they sent her down for more scans, and she'd actually had a secondary bleed in the brainstem.
What was your mother's legacy, do you think?
My mum's legacy was she was a very giving person, a very always cared about others and always gave to others, and hence the organ donation. Like, to me, every year when we went to renew her licence, she would say, "See this box here I've ticked? This is because if anything ever happens to Mummy, I want my organs to be used. My spirit's already gone to heaven, and I want someone to be able to live if I can't." And Mum had it on her licence, and she also had registered on the Donate Life Register. But the most distressing part of this whole process for me and for my family was that I still had the power to overturn her wishes. And that was huge, because even up until probably an hour or two before they were turning the machine off, and we'd said, yes, go ahead, get the ball rolling, they'd flown people in by air ambulance, they got these recipients hopes up, thinking they're getting an organ, yet until that last moment, I still had the power to overturn it, because you only have 3 minutes to say goodbye to your loved ones once they're pronounced dead, because they need to get the ball rolling quite quickly. They have everyone prepped in theatre, ready to go. So that was a really tough moment, because I could have reneged. It would have been quite easy, but yeah, I know that I would have regretted that decision for the rest of my life.
Are you aware of how many recipients there were?
Yes, we know that there's definitely 3 so far. There was 2 people got a kidney each. One lady got a lung, mum's lungs. She had a double lung transplant. They actually took corneas, but because of an injection mum had had for an overactive thyroid, they weren't viable. And also her heart muscle went for research, and heart valves went. And I recently just found out that the heart valves can actually, they're still there. They're not, they haven't been transplanted yet, but they actually have a long, there's different time frames for different organs.
Oh, right.
So they could still be transplanted.
Leah, thank you very much for being on today's show and telling us your story.
My pleasure.
I'm sure your mother would be very, very proud of you. And it's as easy, you know, last week I got my license done, my new driver's license.
Oh,
just tick 2 boxes and that's it.
Did you do it?
Yeah, of course I did. And it's very, very easy to do.
And the donate register takes 2 minutes.
That's
right. You can do it through Medicare. So it's just something, but I cannot stress enough how important education is, and talking to your loved ones and letting them know that these are your wishes. And if they know you feel strongly about it and you're passionate about it, then that makes their jobs so much easier. Mm.
I'd now like to welcome to the show Trevor Clark. He's the Director of Education and Research at Autism Spectrum Australia. Welcome to the show, Trevor.
Yes, thank you.
Now, in your role, you must come across many different groups in society, and, you know, it's a non-for-profit organisation, and you really do extraordinary work out there. Tell our listeners a little bit about Autism Spectrum.
Yeah, Autism Spectrum, we originally were an organisation that was established well over 40 years ago, and initially established by parents of children with autism who were seeking, help for their children in an educational setting. Because I guess way back then, you know, number one, there's very little known about the disability of autism spectrum disorder, and there were, you know, virtually no accommodations made to educate children on the autism spectrum. So that was really our beginnings, and again, you know, still today, we're very much, focused on being family-centred, And currently the Board of Directors of Autism Spectrum Australia still has, you know, many parents of those either children or adults with autism spectrum disorder. And again, our service from very small beginnings, you know, is now one of the largest not-for-profit autism-specific service providers in Australia. And we currently operate in three states, New South Wales, in Victoria, and the ACT. And I guess our organisation, again, a few years ago became a national organisation, and that was really driven by the huge unmet need right across Australia to support, you know, children, adults and their families on the autism spectrum.
When it comes to autism, what are some early indicators?
Some of the very early indicators are, I guess, a difference in the interaction or the social interaction, you know, between the child and the parent. And, you know, there is a qualitative difference where perhaps, you know, there may not be the regular or normal eye contact.
Yeah.
Well, some of the, you know, we now understand that some of the very initial bonding that's really important between the parent and the child is often not quite happening with a child on the autism spectrum. Some of that very early social bonding, we call it reciprocal interaction and communication, is, seems to be failing at the outset, and that really is so important to lay down the, you know, foundation for social interaction. And, you know, so sometimes the children's language is either extremely delayed, you know, beyond the normal milestones. And for some, you know, the children, you know, are basically nonverbal, more at the severe end of the spectrum. Yeah. And again, you know, the behaviours, some of our children do engage in what we call repetitive behaviours. And that's another indicator. The, you know, the behaviours and the play behaviours are somewhat unusual and different. And also there's another component is sensory impairment or sensory sensitivities. So many of our children, you know, are very either oversensitive or undersensitive to, you know, the whole range of senses, touch, taste, smell, hearing, etc.
So as an organisation, what do you do? Like, what do you provide?
Okay, well, right, you know, from the early outset, you know, we provide we've got a diagnostic assessment service that also reaches out into regional New South Wales. And again, you know, if a family, you know, is concerned about their child, they should, you know, take them to see a paediatrician or their GP first. And often, you know, they can, you know, ask for a referral to Autism Spectrum Australia. Beyond that, we offer early intervention services. So we've got a whole range of those for children up to four. We operate schools. We have eight schools now spread throughout New South Wales, which actually makes us one of the largest autism-specific school services, not just in Australia, but worldwide.
Fantastic. Well, we've been chatting with the Director of Educational Research today about autism, Trevor Clark. Thank you very much for joining us on today's Mind Food.
Not at all. My pleasure. Thanks.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Well, Ben, I haven't known a winter like it with all this rain.
There's so much of it around. I was walking through my garden today, and one thing that I've never seen in the garden is pools of water, just pooling it around plants. That can't be good for them.
Well, look, on the show today, and one of our favourite gardeners, welcome to the show, Angus.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Now, what can you really do in your gardens with all this rain?
You mentioned pools of water. I think the first thing to establish is whether you do have a problem with drainage in your garden. Because if you've got a sandy sort of coastal soil, for instance, the water can get away very quickly. But if the water is pooling around for any more than, you know, a day or so, then it's well worth, I'd suggest, even digging some holes to and fill them with water to see how quickly the water gets away through the subsoil.
Okay, good idea.
Then you really need to be thinking about perhaps putting in subsurface drainage like the, what they call ag pipes.
Yeah, ag pipes, yeah. What about, I was on a walk around the block and I saw someone's front lawn and it had been raining continuously over the weekend, and I looked at the ground and where their soil was for their grass, it was almost repelling.
Yes, that's another issue again, which is called a hydrophobic soil. In fact, a soil that hates water. And in the case of soils, they have like horticultural detergents called wetting agents.
Yep.
And you can apply those in different ways, but a wet period is a good time to establish whether you do have a hydrophobic soil, because you, if it's, there's water lying around and you scratch under your soil surface and find it absolutely dry, then that's the perfect indication.
What about, you know, Angus, the big thing when it comes to winter, the old argument is, are leaves that are falling good to put on the garden as they are, or should you put them in the recycling bin and get them taken away?
Look, I think there's two aspects to that. Fallen leaves will make quite a good mulch, which means they just sit on the surface of the soil and kind of, they don't break down very readily, but what they do is insulate the soil, both stop it from freezing if you've got a very cold, frosty climate, or save it from losing so much water. Now, it's a good idea to actually chop the leaves up if they're big leaves, such as a liquid amber or an oak tree, something like that. You can just put them onto your lawn and then mow over them with a catcher on, and that will mulch them up quite well. You can either use them as mulch on top or put them in your compost bin and break them down that way.
Now, Angus, I've got to ask, the bulbs that I've planted a couple of weekends ago, I tell you, they
took them out of the freezer.
But how are they with all? How will they be going with all this rain?
Well, they should really be bolting away as soon as you plant them at this time of year. Really, probably a bit earlier is when you want to be planting your spring bulbs. But they will still grow quite well even if you've planted them this late. And the roots just grow very, very rapidly, and so they're able to absorb a lot of that moisture, but as long as they're not standing in waterlogged soil for more than a few days. So it shouldn't be a problem, provided that subsurface drainage we were talking about earlier is okay.
Fantastic. And we've been chatting with Angus Stewart, of course, all about the wonderful world of gardening. And for more details, jump on to mindfood.com.
My pleasure.
Well, that's a wrap, as we say in the business. Another busy program.
It sure is. And look, I know there's lots of great tips there from Angus re, you know, gardening in the wet, but let's hope this rain stops.
And of course, if you'd like to find out more details on any of the interviews that we've done on today's program or previous programs, just jump onto mindfood.com, and of course, competitions as well. Next week, coming up on the radio show that everybody loves to listen to.
Well, I figured with the cold, we'd talk to our food director from Mind Food all about roasts.
Oh, that's nice.
Of different recipes and things like that. We're also talking to one of the tenors from the Canadian group The Tenors, which will be interesting, and also Matt Clements, who of course has just won Colourist of the Year at the annual Hair Awards.
Very, very nice indeed. Have a nice week. Thanks, Michael.
You too.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia, produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.